short introduction and exercise to some work that you'll be able to do on your own. What I want to do today is just go over a little bit of the data that you all collected actually last week in the TLC experiment. Okay? I've collected all of the information that you had, and we have a pretty good idea as to what might be going on here if you look at these RF values. And once we have, you know, an understanding of what's going on, per se, with the RF values, then what you'll be able to do, and I'll show you how to do this in terms of doing structure searches in the database, you'll be able to pull the structures for aspirin and acetaminophen and caffeine from the Spartan database, and then you'll be able to start collecting property information on that. And at that point, you will actually be in a position to be able to do what was done in that lab report that I handed out to you and we talked about last week. Okay, now, we've only got 3 points here, and one could argue, how can you possibly develop, you know, a reasonable correlation if it exists with just 3 points? And that's a perfectly valid question and problem. I mean, in fact, the underrepresenting of data in statistical problems is like one of the scourges of statistics. Statistics tends to suffer from either of two things. Either you've got 1,000 copies of the same thing, which really doesn't tell you anything. Again, you know, if you have 1,000 copies, pretty much the same observation, and they're all going to cluster in one place, and so, you know, what do you learn new about that? Or you simply don't have enough sampling. Insufficient sampling is one of the biggest difficulties in all of science. And for those of you who are going into sort of the applied areas of biology, your colleagues are the absolute worst with respect to dealing with this, okay? They get 3 or 4 observations, and they think that they have discovered something that should take them, you know, to the Nobel Prize, you know, ceremony. It doesn't work that way, all right? It doesn't work that way. You have to be able to show that there is a general trend in the behavior of things, and it has to be, you know, fairly broadly observable across a very wide variety of observations. Okay. So, for example, if we take a look at the, let's see, I think this was 1-to-1 ethyl acetate methylene chloride, right? So if we take a look at that particular solvent, and we look at acetaminophen, we can see that there's a little bit of variation here, okay? So we go from a minimum of about 0.32 up to a maximum of about 0.5. Now, does that mean that any of those numbers per se are wrong? No, they're not wrong. It's just a matter that some of those observations may fall a little bit beyond what we would expect for, you know, a particular analysis of acetaminophen in that particular solvent. Okay? I mean, there's no problem with this per se, but what you want to do is you want to take a look at all of these observations and say, okay, what kind of number do I have here as my average? My average is just under 0.4. Right? And that, in fact, is a very close value to the average that I've received from all of the other TAs. 0.4-ish is pretty much on the money for that particular solvent for acetaminophen. Aspirin, all right, aspirin runs a little bit faster, so about 0.68 here, and caffeine runs the slowest, about 0.17, and that's perfectly typical for caffeine. Caffeine usually runs in relatively non-polar solvents somewhere under 0.2, all right? Now, we've got a high-end value here of 0.34. Again, is that wrong? It's not wrong. That was the physical observation. Okay, if you see the spot there, you know, you can't argue with it. Now, the sources of error for things like this can be occasionally a little bit of contamination of the actual material that you're spotting. All right, it could possibly be that somebody accidentally put the, you know, the wrong spotter in the wrong place, and so you pick up a little something and that changes it. Occasionally, the solvents themselves may have some minor impurities in them, and, you know, there's no way to get around that. It's a matter that you sometimes have to start from scratch. Right? Okay, so let's take a look at the 10-to-1 ratio for ethyl acetate hexane. Right? So obviously, we're dealing with a solvent here that's almost pure ethyl acetate. Okay? Ethyl acetate, as you probably recall, is one of the classic solvents from nail polish remover. Right? So it you know, does a pretty good job dissolving all sorts of things. But what we see when we see, for example, the numbers for caffeine, again, fairly conservative range here, you know, somewhere between the low teens and you know, the low 20s.
So obviously caffeine isn't interacting very well with either of these solvents, okay? And one of the things that we can almost immediately recognize with a solvent like ethyl acetate, which is the more polar of the two in this picture, we have no hydrogen bond donors on that solvent, okay? And we have no hydrogen bond donors on caffeine. All we have are hydrogen bond acceptors, okay? Now you might think, well, maybe like should dissolve like, you know, because of the fact they both have donors and they both, you know, they don't have any donors and all they have are acceptors. However, the polarity of caffeine is something that's a little bit peculiar because of the shape of the structure and the fact that a lot of the dipole interactions in caffeine are sort of internally canceling. Okay, we'll take a look at that structure in a second. Okay. Aspirin gives its fairly traditionally large numbers, okay, so somewhere in the vicinity of 0.7, 0.8. And acetaminophen gives just a little bit larger number as well. And again, that is suggestive that the 10 to 1 mixture is just a little bit more polar. Now, one of the things that sometimes is a little bit confusing in the 1 to 1, particularly with methylene chloride, methylene chloride is, as they've said in various movies and TV shows, an enigma wrapped in a cookie. Okay? It's an odd solvent. It has an unusual dielectric constant relative to its neighbors of chloroform and methyl chloride as well as carbon tetrachloride. One of the things that's kind of different about this molecule is if you take just a quick look at its geometry, I won't do it with any specific stereochemistry here, but just take a look at the structure. If we look at it with respect to polarity, it has kind of an interesting schema in it, right? It's got two fairly strong carbon-chlorine polarizations there. And it turns out also that we know that the hydrogens become somewhat positive, like that. Okay, so in fact, we've got a little bit of this going on as well. Okay, so the sum of that then, as a vector, is a fairly strong dipole going in the direction of bisector of carbon-chlorine bonds. Okay? So the dipole moment of methylene chloride is a little bit anomalous. And we have two hydrogens here that look like they might be potentially like maybe hydrogen, you know, set up for hydrogen bonding. I mean, it just happens to be that they're not directly connected to the chlorines, but they're both chlorines are connected to a carbon, which is in turn connected to both of those hydrogens. So you get sort of an inductive effect, okay? So there's an inductive effect here. And that inductive effect tends to make these hydrogens more polarized. And in fact, you can, if you go through a series of studies using infrared spectroscopy, show that methylene chloride will hydrogen bond, for example, carbene nucleus, okay? So, is this something that we need to, you know, truly, truly worry about in this context? Probably not, right? Because again, we've only got a one-to-one ratio, so this is not pure methylene chloride, okay? And we have the effect of the interaction potentially even with ethyl acetate, okay? So if you have carmenes, ethyl acetate, the ethyl acetate itself may be interacting with the methylene chloride. And that, in fact, is probably a reasonable explanation for why methylene chloride in mixtures like this, where you have molecules of another solvent that are hydrogen bond acceptors, that the solvent will interact with the solvent because of the sheer volume relative to the relatively small amount of solvent. Okay? So is there a little bit of hydrogen bonding maybe going on between the solutes and methylene chloride? Possibly. Not very much, though, because that's, in essence, being preempted primarily by the fact that we have the ethyl acetate as the cosine. But it's a subtle thing. However, it can make some fairly substantial changes in what your RF values are if you don't have a solvent like ethyl acetate to pick up this interaction. Okay, so it's just something that's a subtle point to be aware of with respect to just the business of trying to interpret this data. Okay, so here's the data that we're going to work with. And by do your students have this, or can you send this out to them on the spreadsheet?
Spreadsheet?
Yeah, you can send the spreadsheet to them.
Yeah.
This way you guys have the averages that you can use, because we're just going to use these six values, in essence, as the RF values for the two columns. Okay? All right, so buddy will send that out to you, and you guys will be in good shape in terms of picking that up. All right, so let me go now to the Spartan interface so that we
can this slide over here.
Yeah, well, there it is. Let's take a look at the Spartan interface real quick, because what we're going to do is we're going to do a search. We're going to sort of take the quick and dirty way of finding these molecules and working with them. And so if you search the Spartan molecular database, it brings up a window here that gives you the opportunity to essentially do a search by name. That's the easiest way to do it. And I'm just going to start out with aspirin. Okay. Now, one of the things I should tell you is that the Spartan database, in terms of its naming conventions, is imperfect. All right. You have to realize that the folks that are putting this database together are generally not like organic or biochemists. They're quantum mechanicians primarily. And so, I'm actually kind of surprised that it has it in there as aspirin. I would expect it to look for acetyl salicylic acid and find it, and I probably find it that way as well. So you have to be careful. You may have to use a couple of different common and or rigorous, IUPAC naming conventions in order to find something. So here's the structure, and we're just going to click on retrieve, and that's going to pop it up in the main window here, and then I'm going to close the search window. So there's our structure. Now this is a particularly convenient situation because a lot of the times you don't want to spend a lot of time constructing relatively simple structures. You want to just be able to grab them and start working with them. Okay, so that's one of the nice things about the database. Let me go down to the bottom here. It may be a little bit hard for you to see it. But right down here at the bottom it says aspirin and there's a little up arrow. I just want to tell you what that is so that you have an idea of what's happening when I click on it. It clicks up, and when you click, it brings up this little pop-up window. And there's the structure, which is the same really as what we have here. And we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe even more. Okay. Six entries in that window. Okay. Each of these entries represents a progressively more sophisticated and assumedly accurate way of assessing the structure, energy and properties of this molecule. Okay. One that all, every entry in this database will have at least something called a 3-2-1-G. Okay. This one happens to be a 6-3-1-G star. All right. Now I'm going to go into all the details of exactly what this means right now because I really want to get to the meat of why we're doing this. I will come back and explain this whole business. These are called cases sets and levels of theory. Right. So it just happens to be that we have a pretty good basis set here. For this structure, and we're just going to close this window because we're perfectly happy with that. And what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at the structure and say, okay, I would like to get some property information about the structure. There's actually in the database some property information, but not all of what we need. If I click on display and then say properties, okay, so display properties, it will pop up a window for me. And this window is sort of a nice universal window when it comes to properties, right? Right now, the entire molecule is selected, so what I'm getting are molecule properties. If I were to simply click on one atom, I would get the atom's properties, okay? If I click on a bond, for example, like this bond, I will get a bond property, okay? The type of bond, the length, whether or not there's a special stereochemistry, whatever. Okay? So if I click again on that bond, I go back to essentially the default. The default is the whole molecule's properties. Now, what you see here, cast number, the total energy, and these are in atomic units. They're also called Hartrees. Just to give you an idea, this is minus 641 Hartrees. 627 Hartrees, I'm sorry, 627 kilocalories are in one Hartree. So this is a really big number. Okay. This energy The second energy includes the energy of what happens when we solve data with water. There is no heat of formation in the database, which is not unusual. We have the dipole moment here calculated at that level of theory, about 2.2 pi's, the atomic weight. Now, we get to a couple of properties that are particularly of interest to us, because they have to do with how we understand the potential changes in the RF values. One of these is the total area, which is just called area here. Right? So the total area of the surface of this molecule is 193 square angstroms. And the PSA, which stands for polar surface area, is about a quarter of it. Okay? Roughly 51. Okay. So you can pull these numbers directly out of the property venue like this and put them into an Excel spreadsheet. Okay? And use that information. Now, what we're going to look at, for example, in our regression study is the dipole moment, the total area, and the polar surface area. And we're also going to use a couple of others. But let me just say one thing about the area and the polar surface area. So what your spreadsheet is going to look like is the RF number one, the RF and solvent number two, okay? Anyone have the dipole moment? Okay. Then you have the area, polar surface area, and you're going to have to do one little bit of arithmetic. And that is, what you want to do is you want to calculate the ratio of the PSA to the total surface area. So the ratio of PSA to total area.
You can just have Excel do that for us, right?
Yep, you want to. That's fine. Okay. And to this, we're going to add two more numbers that I will show you how to compute in a second. Okay. One of them is the ESP, the minimum value, and the ESP maximum value. Okay. Now, there are some times when the number of hydrogen bond donors and acceptors can be of some assistance to you. It happens to be that I think in this particular experiment, it's not going to make a huge difference. So I'll just put dots here, and then I'll just put HBA and HBD. Okay, so if you want to do a little extra analysis, you can see whether or not either of these correlates. I suspect not, but sometimes you get surprises, you know. It's a matter that we do have a situation here between acetaminophen and salicylic acid and caffeine where we do have a fairly dramatic change, or at least a sort of a binary difference in terms of, yes, we do have hydrogen bond donors, and no, we don't. Okay? Sometimes that splits perfectly evenly with what you see in terms of the properties. Okay? You may get a clustering of properties for molecules that don't have hydrogen bond donors, and then clustering of properties of molecules for ones that do have hydrogen bonding. We've only got three candidates here, so you know I'm not too hopeful that this is really going to change things for us. If we're going to find something, it's most likely going to be among these, more likely among these. Occasionally, the dipole is like the wild card. I mean, historically, there have been some very nice studies that have shown that the dipole moment is a really good predictor for the physical properties that we're interested in. Okay, now how do we get to this ESP stuff? Well, that's actually relatively straightforward. What we may need to do here is, the first thing I'm going to do is I want to check to see if there's been any surfaces calculated. Right? And it turns out that there aren't any surfaces calculated. If I go up and hit display surfaces, I can see I don't have any here. So what I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to compute these. And you can do that by going to the setup menu. If you click on the setup menu, you'll notice that the surfaces submenu is already checked, okay? And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to come back down to this menu and just say, let's add some surfaces, all right? Now, again, there's a lot of underlying detail into what's going on here. And again, because we're trying to be brief today, we're not going to go into that detail. Just have you basically follow the recipe that I'm doing. The density surface is, in essence, like a saran shrink wrap around this molecule. Right, just to give you an easy cartoon to think about it. Okay. What we want to do is we want to put the property of the electrostatic potential onto that surface
and we want, in essence, the usual resolution, which is the default, okay? And we're going to say okay. Right? And so what you see is that we have a surface that represents the density, okay, the shrink wrap. We want to map the potential energy of the interaction of a proton with that surface, called the potential. Status is pending because it was not part of the database, and all of these are sort of the default values. Okay, so what we need to do in order to make this go from pending to actually being completed is we need to come back to the setup, and we need to actually set up a calculation. All right. Now, this again has lots and lots of, you know, possible variations in it. However, we are not going to require an equilibrium geometry because this geometry in the database is an excellent geometry. It was already created with that particular good basis set that we talked about. Right? So all we want there is the energy, not the equilibrium geometry. So if I click on that drop down, I simply say energy. Okay? And we're going to use what's called the Hartree-Fock method. All right? And I'm going to change the basis set to 631 G star, which is the one we used. Okay? And I'm going to click OK. And I could have clicked submit directly from that menu, but it's just a habit that I have that I go back and I make sure that my surfaces are the ones that I want, which we have in the open window. And then I click on submit, and it'll come down, it'll bring me a menu now asking me what I want to call this. Right? Because it automatically wants to know if you want to save it or whatever. Yeah.
So could you go back to calculation for a second?
Yeah, sure. Hang on 1 second. Let me just cancel this. So if you go to setup calculation, okay. What we want to do is a single evaluation. All right. So in other words, it's like a snapshot. All right. So if I had a digital camera right now, I took a picture of all of you, that would be the equivalent of saying, I simply want the configuration. What does everyone look like right now? Frozen. Okay. So that's what I'm doing here. I'm using a particular intermediate level of theory. I'm using a reasonable basis. You'll find out that this is a reasonable basis set for the structure. And it's an uncharged molecule, so it's neutral. I don't have to worry about unpaired electrons. I'm not going to do anything else fancy. All I want to do is generate that surface. Okay? So you can either click OK, or you can click now submit, because you're ready to go. Okay? So let's see, do I have one that's just called lowercase aspirin? Let me just call this aspirin. So it tells me that it has started. If we click OK, it should only take a minute or so. And we're done. One of the things that you can do if you're running something that, for example, is going to take multiple steps, like an optimization, you can open the output file, okay? And this will give you information about what's going on. Okay? So what will happen here is that we'll start getting some numbers flying through here, and then we'll be done. One other thing that you can do in order to check on what's happening is you can go up to the options menu, click on monitor. That gives you a little window here that has all the information of what's actually going on. It tells you each step in the calculation, so forth. Okay. So what you will do is you will pull aspirin or salicylic out of the database, go through these steps, generate the property information, and generate the surfaces. As you can see, that thing just blew right through there quite quickly. It takes about a minute, some seconds to go through the calculation, at least on my older machine anyway. And then semi-empirical solvation, this takes a few seconds. Now, interestingly enough, the graphical surfaces, the information that we're calculating on all the surface, that sometimes gets to be the lion's share of the compute time, because there's just a lot of calculations that are done. All right, so now we're done. Okay, so this is completed. Right, I have my output window here. I really don't need anything specific from this output window. This just basically tells me that things are running okay, and as we go through the semester, I will tell you more and more about what all is going on there. Okay, so let's go back up to our surface window now. And now what we can do is we can click
to represent that density and that information, and now we've got our electrostatic potential surface. Okay? Yeah?
My rule for calculating.
You won't calculate it?
Yeah. So, as you say,
oh, is it that? Right, yeah.
The black and out would not supply that. If you go into the monitor, it's
computer. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, the output windows on the Mac versus the PC are just a little bit different, and the Mac being a Unix machine has certain sort of restrictions and capabilities regarding looking at open files. So sometimes you can see some stuff on the Mac in the output window that you might not be able to see in Windows. And sometimes it's vice versa. It all depends on which file you're looking at. So, but yours is running. Okay, so if you hit the if you hit that monitor button under options, then you'll be able to see that it's going. Okay, so here's our surface, all right? That's kind of an interesting surface because it clearly has two very different sides. You don't necessarily think of aspirin as being sort of a chiral type of thing, but in fact it is because of the conformations. Right. So, what I can do now, in order to get some information about this surface, in particular, I'm interested in the minimum value, the minimum most value, and the maximum value of ESP, is to simply click on that object. Okay. So, if I click on this surface, bingo. My properties window now becomes a surface properties window. Okay. And it tells me the minimum value, which is about minus 197 kilojoules. And the most repulsive interaction between a proton. So what we're doing is we're taking a naked proton and rubbing it all over the surface. And in every little step that we take across the surface, we're basically calculating the Coulomb attraction and the Coulombic repulsion. Okay, so here's the Coulombic attraction, here's the Coulombic repulsion between the electron density as represented by that shrink wrap, okay, and this proton that we're taking and just moving along, right? So I deliberately clicked here on the red spot because you can see the actual value. So if you come down from these two, this is the range, and you actually see the value, it's minus 195.2 kilojoules, okay? So I picked a spot that's almost at the most attractive spot between a proton and that surface, okay? And that's not too surprising because that's a carbonyl type of oxygen, okay? Similarly, if I come along and I take a look at the rest of this molecule, I say, okay, the blue represents the most repulsive interaction, or the maximum positive value here. If I click somewhere on this blue, I'm now going to get a number of plus 285, which is pretty close to the maximum. Okay? And so that tells me what's going on at any given point on that surface. Okay? Now, the numbers that we want for our regression, this is the ESP min, this is the ESP max. Okay, so the ESP min is the negative number. All right, so the negative value versus the positive value. Now, if you have a minute or so and you want to take a look at what else you can do with this menu, there's a variety of ways that we can represent this. I think I showed this to you last week. Okay. Same thing there, so it's a matter that you can get that information. One other thing that you can do to help keep track of things, and if you're a fanatic like I am about capturing the graphics and sort of keeping it alongside of what you're doing, is you can click on this thing called the legend, and it'll bring up the values. Okay, so plus 295 down to minus 197. Right, so there, as you can see, you get extremely, extremely repulsive, a little less. Then when you're in the greens here, the bluish to greens, these are relatively neutral because your zero value is right in the middle here, effectively. Right, so once you get down to interactions that are on the order of like plus or minus 20 kilojoules, that's not very much. That represents a hydrophobic type surface. There's really just not much going on there in terms of fire. And further, of course, you're getting more and more negative. That means that you're getting to larger and larger areas of electron density.
So non-bonded pairs, for example, on everything from ethers to amines to esters and acids and amides, any place you have sort of, in essence, a localization of non-bonded electrons, you're going to see the red, you're going to see fairly negative values for that very strong attractive interaction. So that's how you pull these numbers out. Okay? So you get these two additional numbers, and you will then have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 X's. And these are your two Y's. Okay, so you're going to try to model the Y's using those X's. Okay? And if you go into Excel and then click on the table, you simply want to create a scatter plot. All right, I think I went through that. If you have any questions about that, let me know. I can almost talk you through it, as it were, with a series of steps by email, or you can check with Buddy. Or, I mean, you may all know more about Excel than I do, because that's what I found with both of my daughters. I mean, I use both of my daughters as my resource for Excel, because they actually had a course in high school where they basically went through the entire suite of Microsoft Office and Access tools, so they knew a lot more about the guts, as it were, of the Windows-based systems than I did, even though I was an IT director. But if you have a local person that you know who is really good with Excel, you have a question about it, feel free to ask. We're doing a very simple thing. We're creating the scatter plot, okay, X by Y, and you're going to select all of the points and then do a linear fitting, okay? So that'll be in the drop-down menu that you'll have once you, on the Mac, it's a control click. When you select all the points, it opens up a context window, and then you say, no, linear fitting. And also, you want to print the equation on your, you know, on your graph. That way, you'll be able to keep track of what's going on. And you'll be able to see, is the R squared 0.2 or 0 or 0.6, 0.9? No, you won't know until you do. Okay? So that's the exercise that we'll be working on over this next week. Yeah?
Okay, I was just wondering, what's the first lab reports we're actually going to be doing this for?
This is the first lab that you're actually going to be doing some application work on, okay? And what we'll do next week, actually, is discuss how your results look so far. Yeah.
We don't have classes.
Oh, that's right. We don't.
We don't?
No, because we have lecture, but we don't have the lab class. That's correct. I forgot all about that because Monday's the holiday. The Tuesday group has to be off as well, so that everything's in sync. We'll just have to do it the following week. Okay, and if you have any questions about it in the meantime, see Buddy or see me.
So we should have 3 Excel graphs, right?
Well, actually, you're going to wind up with more than that, because remember, what you're going to do is
you're going to have
a pair basically for each one of these.
But for each compound, we should have.
Right. So you'll have 1, 2, 3. Okay. So you'll have. Let's see. I'll put 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B, 3A, 3B. Okay. So you'll have values. You're going to try to model each of these with each of these. So it's going to be, you know, a fair number of them. And most of them are going to just look like nothing. You know, I mean, they're going to be kind of scattered. However, a couple of them may look like that, in which case the regression line that goes through them will look like that. And so your R squared here might be something, you know, 0.75. That's pretty good. That's a decent beginning of a correlation at that point. Okay? So your Y will be here, your X will be here. And this X may be something, like I said, it's probably going to be, if I had to guess, you know, I would look at these two first, okay? And then the rest of these, I'm guessing, are not going to give reasonable regressions. If they do, that's something new, okay? I mean, I haven't done this particular set of molecules, personally. I will do that, just so that I have, you know, a reference point for you guys. But I'm guessing that these are probably not going to be too good. Sometimes polar surface area is okay, but these two guys generally tend to be the better representations, because the ESP maxes and minimums tend to really pull things apart. And so if you have a significant trend here where this is very different than this, which we have, then that tends to do a better job correlating.
So we should have about 36 of these charts?
Yeah.
Number? Okay.
Right. Yeah, if you have a question about, you know, the mechanics of it, just take a look at that example lab report that I emailed guys, okay? Because I think Josh has, I don't know, 18 or 20 or something, 24 or something like that in there. And you'll be able to see that the majority of them don't look so good. But there's, you know, the two or three that you're really looking for.
How reliable is the NMR simulator?
How reliable is it?
It's pretty good. But aren't we submitting the NMR samples this week?
Yes, you are.
So if one of ours comes out really sloppy, can we look at this one? We have just a lot of noise on our ground.
I wouldn't worry about it, because you're not actually going to see your NMRs for what you submit this week and next week until, like, 3 weeks from now. Okay, because the NMR training is, I think, the second week of June. Your TAs are going to look at one time. And what your TAs are going to do is they're going to, the instructions that I generally give them is kind of open-ended. Look at all of your student spectra, find one that looks really, really good, find one that looks really, really bad, and find one that's sort of in the middle. And that's exactly what we see most of the time. We, you know, a couple of people are lucky and the reaction runs to, you know, to completion the way it should, minimum amount of, you know, starting materials. Then you've got some folks that get most of the stuff, but there's a little bit of starting material. And then you have someone who, for whatever reason, in terms of the separation and purification, didn't do that good a job. And so you can see that there's some product there, but the majority of the spectrum is due to the starting material. So it's sort of, I call it the good, the bad, and the ugly. So, you know, and your TA will talk with you about it and discuss, you know, sort of the pros and cons, how to deal with that, as part of the value of NMR. I mean, one of the things that we do with things like IR and NMR is look at the progress of reactions. Okay? Then we go back, we change the reaction conditions, look at the NMR or IR again, go, okay. This time we heated it longer, or we used this particular solvent, that had a positive influence on the product outcome. So that's how we use that. Okay? If you have any questions about this, you know, just drop me an email. See Buddy. Between the two of us, we should be able to walk you through what you need to do. And again, these three molecules are all in the database, so you won't have to do any molecule construction. I will talk about that the next time that we meet and show you, you know, some of the shortcuts. Easy way to manipulate these things, but the really nice thing about this, the fact that the new student version, which you guys have, has this database. I mean, this was something that a lot of the professors and I argued for, across the country with the people at Wave Function. You need to put some reasonable size database in there so that the students aren't wasting all their time just click, you know, drawing all these things. So they did do that, and that really makes life easier because you can see in the properties window. There's, you know, three or four properties right off the bat that you've got like that, that you don't necessarily have to do the calculations. I mean, not all calculations require that you do the ESP readings. Okay. All right. So I'll let you guys head on upstairs again, buddy. Your groups can work in pairs, so that'll help you guys get things done a little faster. The one thing I would recommend you do is to and with this Grignard reaction, we're very, very strict about what. Who can do what at what time in the laboratory because of the fact that we're dealing with diethyl ether. Diethyl ether, you may or may not realize, has a flash point that is below our current room temperature. Okay? So that literally means if I had a can of it here and I opened it up, I could have a plume of flames coming out of it. All right? Not trying to scare you. I just want you to understand that, you know, some of these solvents can be a little bit dicey. All right? So what you're going to be doing is you're going to be putting your equipment together, you're going to be drying that equipment and so forth, and then everybody has to effectively be done use of any drying, whether it be the oven or a flame, and then once all flames and, you know, all heat sources are extinguished, then Buddy will be able to give you guys the ether that you need. You'll be able to put that in and get the reaction going. Now, my recommendation is to start the Grignard first, because you're going to have a few minutes when you're just going to be waiting for the thing to just sort of sit there and bubble by itself. At that point, you'll actually be able to get started on the Diels-Alder reaction, because the Diels-Alder reaction is literally solution A, solution B, put them together, that's let it sit. Tape it up, all right? And then you look at it on Thursday. So it's one of the coolest reactions around. The saying is that the Diels-Alder is such an effective reaction, the only thing it doesn't do is isolate the product. So, But it does. You'll see, what you're going to see by Tuesday is that you're going to get these nice blocks of solid popping out of it. And the question is going to be, is that the kinetic product or is that the thermodynamic product? And in the heat that we have in the lab these days, I don't know if we're even going to be able to see the kinetic product, but we're going to try. That's the whole idea behind doing experimentation. All right, folks. All right, we'll see you upstairs.